Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the riots in Hong Kong, where citizens are protesting China's imposition of candidates chosen by the PRC in the next election, as opposed to local, popularly elected candidates. Susan Shirk, the chair of the 21st Century China Project at the University of California, San Diego, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, joins us to discuss whether China can put down the protests of thousands of people blocking the main road into the financial central district of Hong Kong, and how much the protests will resonate on the mainland as the Communist Party seeks to contain its citizens' growing demands for greater freedom and accountability. Then we'll look into the explosive story broken by NPR's This American Life in conjunction with ProPublica that exposes the capture of Federal Reserve regulators by the big Wall Street banks, in this case Goldman Sachs, where a bank examiner who joined the New York Fed as part of a new wave of post-2008 crash examiners secretly taped recorded meetings in which it is painfully clear that the regulators are pathetically deferential to the bankers, revealing a culture of cowardice and collusion that is designed to deceive the public into believing that there is actually oversight over Wall Street. William K. Black, the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who put hundreds of bankers in jail for the savings and loan ripoffs during the 1980s, joins us to explain how these revelations answer the question of why bankers today are too big to jail. Then finally, we'll hear from William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He joins us to discuss his article at Politico, Why the Fed Will Always Wimp Out on Goldman, and explain the culture of regulatory capture on Wall Street that these secret tapes expose, and what the likely outcome will be from the Congress and the public now that the delusion that there is such a thing as regulation of the banking industry has been laid bare. And joining us now is Susan Shirk, who's the chair of the 21st Century China Program and the director of the University of California's Initiative on Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Ho Mui Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened Its Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Susan Shirk.
Thank you very much, Ian. Good morning.
Good morning. And it's obviously very late in Hong Kong, and we did sort of rouse a few sleepy people with tear gas in their eyes. But do you think that this situation, it's sort of a bit of an Occupy situation that's going on now, and the financial center is being blocked by thousands of protesters. And I take it that as far as the new Chinese leader is concerned, this is a red line, is it? He wouldn't want this kind of contagion of democracy to spread into China, I imagine.
Well, that's quite correct. The demonstrations in Hong Kong right now are actually being driven mostly by students, university students, high school students, and other young people. And the democratic movement in Hong Kong, which was organizing an Occupy Central protest to begin later this week, it has now announced that they will be following the students because the students got such massive numbers of demonstrators mobilized. And it's kind of a standoff with, I guess, at least tens of thousands of students in the Central District. And the police have used, and by the way, this is Hong Kong police. This is not PRC troops or police. This is Hong Kong police. And they've quite well prepared for this, and they have used tear gas, warning the students as they go along. But the students are also well prepared with masks and plastic. The police are threatening to use rubber bullets, not clear what impact that will have, and there are some reports that the students are withdrawing for the night and then planning to return tomorrow. I'm not exactly sure if that is the case or not. So that's an unpredictable situation in Hong Kong, as all protests are, but you're absolutely right that Xi Jinping and the other Chinese leaders in Beijing are really taking a very firm position on the growth of democracy in Hong Kong, and they have I'm pretty sure that they're not going to compromise the least bit to accommodate the demonstrators and others in Hong Kong who would like to see the growth of democracy.
So, Susan Shug, would the ghosts of Tiananmen come back in any way to haunt them? How much is the Chinese public aware of what's happening in Hong Kong? And presumably, the idea of students protesting hits a very, very sensitive button, doesn't it?
Well, certainly it does. And there are some horrific stories of young teenagers who were detained by the police without any legal proper legal due process, and other things that will certainly arouse the sympathy of many people. And it is impossible to keep this entirely secret from the people on the mainland. They will know about it. But whether or not it stimulates a kind of groundswell of protest on the mainland is something I seriously doubt that will occur. For one thing, there is a certain amount of social resentment of mainlanders to the Hong Kong people who have been treating the massive numbers of mainland tourists who visit Hong Kong. They've not been treating them well. They really don't like them coming, even though, of course, they bring business with them. I just don't think the protests in Hong Kong necessarily resonate with people on the mainland unless they're already committed Democrats, and that's a pretty small minority of people on the mainland.
Again, I'm speaking with Susan Shirk, who's the chair of the 21st Century China Program and the director of the University of California's Institute on Global Conflict and Cooperation, and the Ho Mui Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened Its Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. So the idea then that the contagion won't necessarily spread, but when you mentioned a minute ago how Chinese mainland tourists come to China and the Hong Kong Chinese probably look down their noses at them, my understanding is a lot of these people are coming to buy things like diapers and baby formula and stuff that they don't trust their own products back on the mainland. We've had so many stories of contamination of infant formula and dog food that kills pets, etc. So why aren't they more angry at their own people, at their own government on the mainland? And why this? What do they think? Does one side, the mainlanders, think that the people in Hong Kong are sort of haughty and look down on them, and why do the people in Hong Kong, if that is the case, why do they not look down on their brethren?
Well, first of all, I don't want to exaggerate the importance of this tension about mainland visitors to Hong Kong. I mean, that's just a sort of one factor, but not necessarily the defining factor of how this plays out. And the question of why mainlanders have been acquiescent to the repressive government that they live under, I think it's a combination of a number of things. Probably the most important is that with the Chinese economy growing so fast, people's living standards have really improved dramatically. And, you know, almost everyone is better off than they were, 20, 30 years ago. And so people know that, and they remember it. young people, of course, don't remember it as well, and that's where there's always a question mark. But so long as they're able to get decent jobs, they seem pretty politically quiescent. The second factor is coercion and repression. I mean, in most respects, you know, China is it's a vibrant market economy, open to the world, and yet in many ways it's still a police state. And the repression has only grown more intense under Xi Jinping, including controls over the media. And then the third factor is that when things go wrong, problems like food and medicine quality or environmental pollution or other things that really upset people, the central government has a great way of identifying with people's, you know, complaints, agreeing that they're really a serious problem. And then most of the time they try to blame local officials for the problem or bureaucrats. And right now there's a massive anti-corruption campaign, which is being carried out by Xi Jinping, which is hugely popular with the Chinese public. And they think Xi Jinping, ruling like a strong man and attacking corrupt officials, is a great hero.
But isn't it largely cosmetic? He's really, again, as you point out, he's going after the low-level provincial people, but not the high-level party chiefs. I mean, my understanding is that hundreds of billions of dollars have been salted away in Vancouver and Australia and other places, and that and the children of the elite have moved all offshore, all this money. The level of corruption at the top, we got a bit of an inkling into that. There was a trial, of course, of the Chinese official whose wife organized the murder of a British businessman.
Yeah, Bo Xilai.
And of course, the British businessman was a cutout to launder the money. So isn't there...
Well, but, you know, what's completely new about Xi Jinping is that he is going after higher-level officials. Now, mostly retired ones. But there had been an informal agreement that no member of the Politburo and the Standing Committee of the Politburo, the top elite, would be prosecuted for corruption. But Xi Jinping has abandoned that rule, and he's gone after Zhou Yongkang, who is the retired but very senior security czar. Zhou Yongkang, under the previous administration, so Zhou Yongkang and large numbers of his family and associates are now being held and are being prosecuted for corruption charges. Zhou Yongkang hasn't quite yet been brought before a court of justice, but that's going to happen pretty soon, I'm sure. And really remarkably, he went after one of the very top generals, now retired, Xu Zaiho, for selling ranks in the military. And that is, you know, really taking on a major issue, corruption within the military. So all I'm saying is Xi Jinping is really something new in Chinese politics, and what he's doing right now is very popular with the public.
So, but it also serves, I imagine, to further this determination on the part of the Chinese Communist Party, as they learn from Gorbachev, who actually was in China at the time of Tiananmen, and of course Glasnost, which was meant to stimulate perestroika in Russia, actually became the emperor's has no clothes, and the whole thing unraveled, and the Chinese appear to have decided that they'll never submit to glasnost, but they'll have unlimited perestroika. So is this another shadow game in that regard, that to distract the people from any desires for glasnost with the idea that we're cleaning house?
Yes, I think Gorbachev is definitely the negative role model for Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders. and they're doing everything they can to keep the Chinese Communist Party in power. And they're very agile, and they're very tough, and they're very determined.
And this Hong Kong thing, what is that to them? A bit of a blip on the horizon?
I think it's very serious to them. They take all of these, what they call instability threats, very, very seriously. And if the demonstrations continue to build in Hong Kong, despite the very professional Hong Kong police efforts using non-lethal methods, then I think it's entirely possible that this would be a hard thing to do, but I think it's possible that Beijing could declare martial law in Hong Kong. And that, of course, would be a major escalation of the reaction that could trigger some sympathetic responses on the mainland.
But in terms of international financial community, if China were to effectively occupy Hong Kong and tear up the agreement that they have with the British, I think it's called one country, two systems or something, the way it was described, if that becomes a fiction, what advantages do they have of having a kind of offshore trading operation, that's obviously, there must be some financial advantage to China for having Hong Kong the way it is. If they lose that, what do they lose?
Well, I think right now they have Shanghai, they have Shenzhen, they have a lot of alternatives to Hong Kong. So Hong Kong, in terms of the economy and the financial system, is much less important than it used to be. And we saw the reaction of the British and even the Americans to the determination of Beijing that they were not going to permit any real expansion of the franchise to choose their own leaders. And the British, even though the basic law that they're operating under in Hong Kong was a treaty between China and the United Kingdom registered with the UN that the UK has a lot of responsibility for, they just totally folded. They made no major stink about it. And of course, the U.S. has a lot of other issues with China that are viewed as more important than the Hong Kong situation. And so China, because of its importance in the global economy and its growing power, is, you know, able to get away with this kind of repression in Hong Kong as well as on the mainland.
Well, what I'm interpreting from what you're telling us, Susan Shirk, is that it may well be likely that China could move in and just literally take over the place, tear up the agreement.
No. I'm not saying that. Uh-huh. I'm saying it would be a major escalation for them to declare martial law in which some, say the military, People's Liberation Army forces who are based in Hong Kong, they're there permanently. They've been there since the handover, might join with the police to try to enforce order. And, of course, martial law would involve different kinds of punishment of the demonstrators as well. So in order to restore order, they might impose martial law, but it doesn't mean tearing up the agreement, because from Beijing's point of view, even under the basic law, they have every authority to do that. You know, Hong Kong is part of China.
So in other words, they could crack down, but they don't necessarily, once they've done that, they don't necessarily have to keep in place martial law and effectively continue it. I see. Well, I look forward to, by the way, I look forward to hosting you at the UCLA Hammer Forum here in Los Angeles, Susan Shirk, on Wednesday, November the 19th. The title of our forum is China, Fragile Superpower, which is the title of a book of yours and some colleagues from the 21st Century China program at UC San Diego School of International Relations and Pacific Affairs will be joining us, an expert on the economy of China and an expert on the Chinese military. So again, that's Wednesday, November the 19th at the UCLA Hammer Forum in Los Angeles, China.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, too. It'll be nice to meet you in person after talking.
Well, thank you. Thank
radio
you.
With you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you for joining us here today.
Okay, my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Susan Shirk, who's the chair of the 21st Century China Program and director of the University of California's Institute of Global Conflict and Cooperation and the Hong Wei Lam Professor of China and Pacific Relations at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. In the Clinton administration, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of East Asia and Pacific Affairs, and her books include How China Opened Its Door, China, Fragile Superpower, and her latest, Changing Media, Changing China. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the explosive story broken by NPR's This American Life in conjunction with ProPublica.
And the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair mental weather, each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William K. Black, who's the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and was previously executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. And he's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Black.
Thank you.
And as a result of these extraordinary expose broken by NPR's This American Life in conjunction with ProPublica, it seems the best way to rob a bank, rob the country, is to basically pretend that there's such a thing as oversight and have the people in the government that are supposed to regulate you, who are in the building, in this case, in Goldman Sachs' headquarters, basically have them as little lapdogs that, you know, they don't even yap, let alone bark.
Yeah, I mean, it's wrong on so many different dimensions simultaneously that it's even difficult to talk about the subject. First, having examiners reside at the banks is a terrible idea. The saying within the regulatory ranks is that they always marry the natives. Now, you eat lunch with the folks. You share stories about your kids and such. These are not people that you're willing to clamp down on and criticize severely. So it's a system that can't work. We've known that it can't work and doesn't work for decades. And the Fed and the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, are still addicted to this form.
Well, the story begins, I guess, with Carmen Segura, the whistleblower. She's a young woman who joined the New York Fed in the post 2008 crash influx of new regulators. Then they were going to get it right. And in fact, there's a recording. And what happened was she secretly tape recorded all of her meetings once she became quickly disillusioned with the fact that they weren't really regulating these guys. They were basically so deferential to them that the whole thing was a farce. And, you know, there's an extraordinarily telling moment. If you listen to This American Life, it's amazing because you learn so much from just listening. If you read the transcript, it's not quite the same. But she was, there's one moment where the regulator, her boss, the chief regulator of Goldman Sachs, is explaining what happened to him in the 2008 crash when he's working for Timothy Geithner, who was his boss, and the whole thing was falling apart, and he got so upset he went into the bathroom and threw up. So he's saying how, you know, dangerous this is and how we need to regulate these people. And then they turn around and they don't even slap Goldman on the wrist. They, you know, I mean, it's just extraordinary.
Yeah, and actually I think that the program, as good as it was, doesn't really explain why what Goldman was doing was outrageous and should have been stopped. I mean, they make the point that it was the deal had no business rationale. It was pure and simple a scam designed to reduce the capital requirement of the largest Spanish bank. And that Spanish bank desperately needed a higher capital requirement instead of a lesser. All right, so the Fed knows this is happening, and it knows that Goldman Sachs, for a very big fee, is helping Bank Santander evade the rules and pose a danger to the global financial system, because Bank Santander is one of those too-big-to-fail banks that could bring down the global economy. So this is an absolute no-brainer from the Fed standpoint. You get in, you scream, you rant, you rave, and you say, we will take you to the wall if you ever even try to assist another bank in a scam like this, and you will not do this deal, and if you think you've done this deal, you will unwind it, and you will unwind it within 24 hours. And not only did those things not happen, none of those things were ever on the table. The most they ever thought of doing was sending a letter. And as the program says, they then, they being the senior regulator types at the Fed, congratulated themselves on how tough they were with Goldman Sachs, because they orally kind of sort of asked the question, why did you do this deal?
Well, what's extraordinary about it, though, William K. Black, is that they actually rehearse in, and she's recorded this whole thing, where the Fed bank examiners are sitting around a table saying, you know, we're really going to take these guys to the mat. We're really going to kick butt, right? And then they all decide, well, who's going to ask the question, the very question that you just alluded to, and then the top guy says, I'll do it. And then she was able to record the actual meeting itself with Goldman Sachs, and you keep waiting for the big shoe to drop, and he finally asks the questions, and it's so mealy-mouthed and so much equivocation that you can't even understand what the question was.
Well, I can understand the question because I'm a lawyer and I understand the context. But no, it isn't the question I asked. It has nothing to do with the question I asked. He asked the hyper-technical question of, hey, in the original documents it said this deal would go forward only if you got a no-objection opinion from the Federal Reserve. And you went ahead and we never gave you the no-objection. So how did this happen? Except that he's not even that pointed. He implies that clause must have dropped out and must have been just in an earlier draft. And he never gets an answer, by the way, to his non-question. But they never ask the real question, which is, this is insane. You are knowingly helping a bank that has way too little capital and threatens the global economic system, reduce further its capital.
to give the illusion that it's actually more solvent because the ratio of exposure to capital, and by reducing the capital, you reduce the exposure. That's the theory, right?
Yes, and remember, the example you just gave where the senior guy says he went into the bathroom and threw up. Okay, that came when what it's called breaking the buck. And that means that the money market mutual funds, which are supposed to be the safest thing you can imagine, actually had losses so great that they couldn't, when you put a dollar in, you couldn't get about a dollar back. And that prompted the largest run in financial history, because it's not run by people like you and me. This is a run by corporations that were taking out tens of billions of dollars every hour from the money market mutual funds. Every money market mutual fund in America was going to fail. And why did that happen? That happened because of the Lehman Brothers failure. And what was the Lehman Brothers failure about in some significant part? A window dressing deal designed to hide liabilities of Lehman Brothers so that its capital position would look better, which is, of course, exactly what Goldman Sachs was doing for Bank Santander. So if he threw up and he wanted to make sure he was never in that position again, this is precisely the deal with the Spanish bank that he should have blocked, and he could have blocked it.
Again, I'm speaking with William K. Black, who's a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. But the other thing, though, which is extraordinary about this story that we're talking about, or this incident, an example of how the regulators, the Fed regulators on Wall Street, have totally captured, and the culture of deference is beyond belief. The Spanish bank also wanted the Fed to sign off on the deal, and that was a part of it. And presumably they signed off on the deal. So they were, you know, there's no question that the Fed wasn't, they can't say that they were dodging the bullet. They were asked specifically to sign off on this deal, weren't they?
No. Well, not according to the senior Fed guy. The senior Fed guy says they never approached me for approval and I never gave it. And that's why he's asking that question, saying, well, you know, what happened? The deal document said that you needed the approval or the non-objection of the New York Fed. And so what happened? Because we never gave you that. You know, did that deal document drop out? Was it just an earlier draft? That's the nature of the question. But that's not really the point. What's really the point is the Fed knew about a transaction that it assuredly should have blocked.
So,
and it didn't even consider blocking it.
Right. Well, I know that Senator Warren and Sherrod Brown are calling for a congressional investigation into this. It seems to me that what's going on here is this is the kind of the Gordian knot, if you will, that finally we've cut through it, to explain why our politicians don't take on Wall Street, why Eric Holder didn't put anybody in jail. It lays bare the correlation of power, if you will. Wall Street really runs the country, runs the politicians, and that the purpose of regulators, whether they're with the SEC or with the New York Fed, are basically to maintain the fiction that there's such a thing as regulation. That's the game that's being played, at least to my mind.
Well, I want to first, you know, tell your listeners that that isn't inevitable, and there actually were regulators in different era, and none of those conversations ever occurred in the organization that I worked for, and it was indeed quite the opposite, and we were famous for taking on those powerful folks. But, I mean, it's not, this is a symptom. So the real thing, of course, is that it was Greenspan and it was Bernanke. I mean, it's the people at the top, and it was Geithner as well. But Greenspan had, remember, right, he had authority under HOEPA, the Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act of 1994, so he had it for over a decade, to ban liar's loans. And even the industry's own anti-fraud experts said that these were fraudulent 90% of the time, 90%. And Alan Greenspan refused to stop liar's loans. He refused when his Fed colleague said, we need to get the facts. We need to send the examiners into the institutions and look at these non-prime loans. Alan Greenspan refused to allow the examiners to get the facts. Now, on top of that, the Federal Reserve banks, the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, are set up with an obvious, absolutely unacceptable conflict of interest in which their board of directors is dominated by the banks and indeed the largest banks. Now, we decided in 1989, which is a whole long time ago, that the equivalent in the savings and loan industry, the Federal Home Loan Banks, which were built in the same way, that was an untenable conflict of interest that could not be permitted to continue. Well, if that's true for the Federal Home Loan Banks, it's even more true for the Federal Reserve Banks. And yes, as a result of these tapes, you see, how even the supposed new guard is not just bad, but just hopeless. I mean, there is no way that a system like this can possibly supervise successfully. And remember also that when Geithner was asked by Congress about his role as a regulator, he said, I have to stop you right there. I was never a regulator. Well, you know, it's true, but you're not supposed to admit it.
Right. Well, the thing that concerns me, though, William Black, is that I don't know if you saw this recent New York Times expose of how the Wall Street is onto a new racket that's a total spin-off of the liar's loan racket that brought about the crash of 2008 in the housing sector with subprime loans and literally taking advantage of poor and middle-class Americans who are aspiring for a better life and their piece of the American dream, and they con them into being a little bit of money down and get into a house that they can't afford, and then suddenly they're just bled dry to the point where they can't pay for it anymore, and they end up living in their cars. Well, guess what's happening now?
And they do it on auto loans, too.
Well, that's what I was about to say. The new racket is the auto loan subprime, and now they're putting devices in cars where if you don't make your payments, the car suddenly freezes on you, et cetera. And that plus they have electronic devices linked to that same device that literally tells everything about what you're doing, where you're going, et cetera, tracking you in this kind of Orwellian way. So in other words, I guess the question is, we need the Fed and the regulators more than ever because they're back to their same tricks on Wall Street.
Well, of course they will be because, and again, we have Eric Holder announcing his resignation, and he's prosecuted not a single one of the CEOs who led the frauds that caused the crisis, right? So all of those people have the equivalent of advanced degrees now in running accounting scams and none of the baggage of a conviction. So they just go on to the next thing, and so it is an absolute disaster. Let me mention also the radio program that you're talking about with the interview favorably mentions at many places and talks to the professor that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York hired to suggest improvements. Now, some of his suggestions make perfect sense, and some of his analysis makes perfect sense, but his report, for example, never even mentions the word fraud. And it only mentions the compensation systems that drive these frauds in one place, you know, in 30 pages type of thing. So it's a report by a, you know, management type that really has no experience as a financial regulator and has no idea what caused the financial crisis or how to deal with it. So on every level, even the purported efforts at reform, as her own, you know, her example and her tapes show, but also in terms of the people they hire to allegedly tell them how to reform things, they're ridiculous. Why not look at successful cases of examination and supervision and bring in the people who did that?
Well, William K. Black, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who's the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back hearing from William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohan is a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times, where he covers a variety of financial issues. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, The Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company, and he began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half at Lazare Fred and J.P. Morgan Chase. He has an article at Politico, Why the Fed Will Always Wimp Out on Goldman. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you, Ian.
So answer your question, if you will, Bill. Why will the Fed, will always wimp out on Goldman?
The Fed will always wimp out on all the big Wall Street banks because the big Wall Street banks, people have forgotten, unfortunately, understandably, I guess, consider that the Fed was created 100 years ago, and there aren't many people around who were alive 100 years ago. But 100 years ago, through an act of Congress at the suggestion of J.P. Morgan, the man himself, the Federal Reserve System was created. It was created to benefit Wall Street. It was created by Wall Street for their benefit. And when the New York Federal Reserve Bank, the most powerful bank in the network of 12 banks, was being created, the committee of two cabinet members in Woodrow Wilson's administration who were setting up the Federal Reserve System came and consulted with Henry Goldman, then the senior partner at Goldman Sachs and the son of the founder of Goldman Sachs, Marcus Goldman, and consulted with him about how the New York Federal Reserve Bank should be established and set up and how it should be run and who it should be serving. And basically they agreed it should be serving Wall Street and be the lender of last resort to Wall Street. So there's no secret here. There's never been a secret here about who the Federal Reserve System benefits. It has the illusion of benefiting the American people, but it works for the benefit of the big Wall Street banks.
So having these, this whole thing laid bare as it is in these secret tape recordings that were put together by This American Life and the investigation was done in conjunction with ProPublica, what kind of a teachable moment is this? Because, you know, you recall when, for example, the secret recordings of Richard Nixon's White House were revealed, people were shocked at the language. And if they've seen this recent documentary, they ought to be shocked at what an incredible anti-Semite the guy was and how, you know, extraordinary it was to have somebody like that. Those things, to me, I think are a breath of fresh air. Is there any way that we can get, I mean, your point's well taken, but at this point, don't you think we should either decide whether or not we have kabuki theater or whether it's real, and should it be real or should it not be real?
Look, I mean, I read the ProPublica article with a great deal of interest. I listened riveted to the This American Life segment. On the one hand, I can certainly understand what appealed to the producers of This American Life and the editors at ProPublica about this story. I have to say, though, the more I learn about it, the more I think that it's not particularly a revelation. It's not, frankly, to me, a teachable moment. I think it's been sensationalized, and I'm actually kind of disappointed in if this does sort of get legs. I'm disappointed in the fact that they've chosen to make this into a much bigger deal than it is. And let me just make clear that I think that there's a huge need for reform on Wall Street, but to expect the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve banks to do that is, to my mind, complete folly unless we're going to throw out the whole system, which is fine. That may very well be an option, but without a central bank, we could have a lot of financial chaos. But to expect the New York Fed to regulate Wall Street when the head of the New York Fed now is a former Goldman Sachs partner on the board of the New York Fed for a long time, have been Goldman Sachs partners. Former New York Fed presidents, Jerry Corrigan, is now a partner at Goldman Sachs. All these tapes that this Carmen Segura made. I mean, if you think about it for a minute, she had been there 7 months. She was disgruntled, and she then proceeded to make 48 hours of secret tapes. Now, I listened to This American Life yesterday, and I have to say that she's not, by any stretch of the imagination, a model employee. She, did, I think, a great disservice by secretly taping her colleagues and then using these tapes to somehow suggest that people at the New York Fed weren't doing their jobs. The people at the New York Fed, again, exist for the benefit of Wall Street, so let's not get confused about what they're supposed to be doing. And if you actually parse through what Ms. Segura was actually complaining about, I think she got a number of things wrong, and I'm not surprised she got fired, frankly.
But our previous guest, William K. Black, who was the head of headed up the investigations into the savings and loans rip-offs of the 1980s and was responsible for putting hundreds of bankers in jail, he was saying that there is a role for the Fed, and it changed that the regulators used to regulate. But when Alan Greenspan came along, and particularly when people under him were starting to warn him about these liar's loans coming out of Wall Street leading up to the crash with the subprime housing racket, which, by the way, now the latest one, according to the New York Times, is they're doing subprime loans for automobiles now. But just staying with Greenspan, he just refused requests from investigators to look into what was happening. What explains that? I mean, in other words, is it possible, if notwithstanding these long-term relationships and how much the Fed was set up in the first place to serve Wall Street, still there are cops on the beat, and it's, if you got a cop on the beat who's asleep or so ideological that he doesn't want to look at something that sort of upsets his kind of free market ideology, in the case of Greenspan, who now is very contrite about what happened, is that something that we have to consider, surely?
Well, there's no question that one of the points in the This American Life segment was this idea of regulatory capture, where somehow the Wall Street banks, the big banks, are able to co-opt the regulators into, not prosecuting them for wrongdoing. I mean, Mr. Black is absolutely right that after the savings and loan crisis, the FT, I think, reported that there was like 3,500 bankers who were put in jail as a result of that wrongdoing. That savings and loan crisis in the late 80s pales in comparison to what we all just experienced in 2008 and 2009. And as we all know, not a single Wall Street banker has been held criminally accountable for what went wrong there. So there's clearly a huge failure to hold people accountable for what went wrong. I blame the Justice Department for that. I blame the SEC for that. I blame various U.S. attorneys for that. Again, I think that needs to be, and we have Eric Holder, just quote-unquote resigning, and people are trying to decide what his legacy shall be. And, I don't hear a whole lot about how he failed to prosecute the wrongdoing at these Wall Street banks. I hear a lot about his civil rights success, but, the fact of the matter is he allowed these banks to get away with paying big fines using their shareholders' money, and that is not the same as prosecution. In the case of what was on this American Life tapes with Carmen Segura, the New York Fed, it has become, the Federal Reserve has become, quote, the prudential regulator of Wall Street. But again, the New York Fed, the most powerful Federal Reserve Bank, can demand change on Wall Street. But, what she was focusing on, and again, I don't want to get lost, in the weeds here, but what she was focusing on was whether, Goldman Sachs had a conflict of interest policy. I mean, the fact that she would waste 5 or 6 months trying to figure out whether Goldman Sachs had a conflict of interest policy, of course, Goldman Sachs, whether it has one or it doesn't have one, it is constantly involved with conflicts of interest, and that is the problem, not whether it has a conflict of interest policy or not. There's a huge opportunity for reform still on Wall Street. There's a huge leadership vacuum on Wall Street now, and I think if Wall Street were really smart, leaders would emerge to start leading the reform, because the Dodd-Frank law, the Volcker rule, and all of the regulations that are still being written are not doing a darn thing to change the behavior on Wall Street.
But isn't there something relevant, though, about what this particular case at the Spanish bank? Because my understanding is that what this Spanish, and this is what Bill Black was explaining to us a minute ago, that what they were doing by literally fixing the books to make it look like the exposure to capital ratio for this bank was healthy when it wasn't, and they were making it even more unhealthy. Isn't that exactly the same mechanism that took place with Lehman Brothers that brought about the greatest run on the market?
Wall Street is filled with very smart people who are anxious to get fees for providing services to solve problems for companies around the world. And I'm not just sort of glossing over this. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, again, if you listen to the This American Life segment, you'll hear that the regulators at the New York Fed acknowledged that deal that Goldman was trying to do for Banco Santander was perfectly legal. Okay, now that's the problem. If that kind of a deal, where you can basically allow Goldman to get a fee of $40 million plus for making it look like Banco Santander was better capitalized than it actually was, and shareholders and creditors don't understand the real situation at Banco Santander, that should not be legal. Okay, but the fact that it is legal is the problem, not that Goldman Sachs, you know, Goldman Sachs did something, you know, whether we like it or not, that was quote-unquote legal. So the problem is not that Goldman Sachs did it. The problem is that it's legal to do it, and if it shouldn't, and it shouldn't be legal, if it's clouding over the true financial picture of what's going on at Banco Santander.
And Banco Santander, I understand, is the largest bank in Spain, and Spain has economic problems, and the euro has economic problems, and if it were to go under, it would have a huge negative impact of unraveling the global economy, wouldn't it? I mean, that's
absolutely.
Isn't that isn't that where the rubber meets the road? Isn't that where our focus should be?
Well, I mean, again, we shouldn't have sham transactions.
Right.
Sham transactions should not be allowed to happen. Again, for the New York Fed to worry about a transaction that is legal, that may be a sham transaction, I guess that's a good use of time. But the fact is that those kinds of sham transactions should not be legal at all. And you know, on the flip side, you could argue, well, just like what happened in our own financial meltdown, if Goldman and Morgan Stanley and all the banks had been allowed to fail, okay, we would have had perhaps out of those ashes a more secure financial system, because the architecture of Wall Street would have been completely changed as a result of that disaster. But hundreds of thousands of people would have been put out of work. The economy would be in shambles for years, even more so than, you know, people think it is now. And so the decision was made to bail out these firms. So, again, the decision was made to allow Goldman Sachs to create this sham transaction with Banco Santander to keep Banco Santander, the largest bank in Spain, economically viable, and so that it didn't collapse and that people didn't get thrown out of work. I mean, so, again, there are always these trade-offs, and people like, you know, Alan Greenspan and Milton Friedman who pretend, who always espouse sort of free market capitalism, you know, they're like the first ones to, Lewis, it was the Republicans in the Bush administration that came to the rescue of Wall Street and created these huge bailouts. These people, I mean, Henry Paulson, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs at the Treasury, was the one who orchestrated these bailouts with Ben Bernanke, and you would have thought that these Republicans would not have bailed out these firms, but they decided that the bailouts mm-hmm. were a better course of action than letting them all fail.
Right, but just in closing, though, the missing ingredient was, if you're going to bail out these guys for outrageous and criminal behavior with taxpayers' money in the largest transfer of private debt into public debt in the history of mankind, you ought to get something in exchange for it, and they didn't, I guess.
I agree with that completely.
Well, Bill, we're running out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with William Cohen, who's the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He's a contributing editor at Fortune and a writer for Vanity Fair and the New York Times, where he covers a variety of financial issues. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company. And he began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Laissez Faire and J.P. Morgan Chase. His latest article at Politico is Why the Fed Will Always Wimp Out on Goldman. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.